Probably longer than anybody else in this room, longer than most people in the world. Ray has a tremendous amount of experience with growing crops in controlled environments and has had the advantage that economics have probably not been a major concern in the production, and he's going to share some of his experiences and talk about how the work that NASA has done can contribute to vertical agriculture. Ray?
Thank you, Mark, and thank you all for attending this morning. This was great to hear the first two talks. As Mark mentioned, NASA has had a long-standing interest in controlled environment agriculture, and the reason being is for life support systems in the future. And if you look at this graphic, you'll see kind of a simplified metabolic chart. Humans, there we are on the top of that. We eat food, we use up the oxygen in the rooms, and we generate CO2. And we are good at generating wastewater. Plants, being far more noble organisms, can drive this back the other way, but they need a lot of light energy. They take the CO2, they can create oxygen. That's something we need in space for future life support systems. And if you pick the right kinds of plants, you can get food from them. If you grow tomatoes instead of crabgrass, you can get some edible biomass. And also, something you might not think about is plants are good distillation systems, and so you can use that to your advantage in a closed system to purify water. It gets a little more complicated. So in terms of, you have to process it first and polish it and add biocides, things of that nature. So with that kind of backdrop of NASA's interest, what I thought I would do today is kind of give some historical background of NASA's activities, and a lot of people I see sitting in this room were involved with that. Then I'll give a little bit of some more of what we learned about in terms of crop physiology in controlled environment systems, because I think this helps kind of frame the challenges in terms of managing these systems. And then I'll actually show you some pictures of our vertical farm, and then kind of wrap it up with that. Okay, well, there's a long-standing interest in NASA's investments in this area, and you'll notice that a lot of it was done through university investigators. Many are sitting in this room. Carrie Mitchell, Bruce Bugbee, Bob Morrow was involved back there, and you can see some of those top bars. And this goes back quite a ways, but during the 1980s and 90s, NASA was funding grants for a lot of investigators to specifically study and become experts in certain crops. And you'll notice that those crops were, you might say, more agronomic type crops, field crops. And the thinking at that time was more mature, large-scale life support systems. With the exception of something like lettuce but a lot of these things were, you might call, staple crops. And so that was the thinking at that time. It's changed now, and we've kind of gone a bit back. And then there were NASA centers that were involved with this. You see NASA's Ames Research Center. I work at Kennedy Space Center and Johnson Space Center. And so there was sort of a integrated program going there. And it was a very vibrant and active community at that time. Unfortunately, things have slowed down a little bit, funding issues, you know, those tend to affect things. So for space, what are you interested in? You saw that chart with wheat and soybeans and potatoes, things like that. We're obviously interested in high yielding and nutritious crops. Ultimately, we want to produce the oxygen for the crew and remove the CO2, and we want to get the food that's very nutritious. Another thing that's a big issue for us is harvest index. If you're going to generate biomass, you want as much of it to be edible as possible. This has two intrinsic advantages. Number one, it gives you more fundamental food production per unit area or per unit volume, as Nate was and Ed were addressing. And it reduces your waste biomass. That's another issue that you have to think about in terms of closed systems. What do you do with inedible biomass? You have these bales of hay. Are they a resource? Are they something you can deal with? You know, it's a separate issue. You have to think about the horticulture. This is pretty obvious to this community, and the environmental considerations, and we just heard a lot about that. Things like processing, that's a big issue. If you're growing soybeans, can you thresh them out? Can you clean them up? It's a dusty operation. You're in a closed, tightly closed environment. You have to cook them, prepare them, extrude them. I mean, it gets complicated when you think about these things. And so some crops are a little bit better in those regards than others. And we're also very interested in dwarf or low-growing type plants, and this is because we are very interested in three-dimensional volumetric issues. We don't have infinite vertical dimension. In fact, we're very vertically constrained in terms of space systems. And so that's a big issue, and so it's been a thrust of. So you go back to that graph I showed of the groups that were involved. A lot of the research was focused on hydroponic systems, and in particular recirculating hydroponics. And this was because at that time we were thinking largely of planetary surface systems on the surface of Mars, on the surface of the Moon. You would have some gravity. So you can use that to a mechanical advantage. If you're in a weightless setting, like the International Space Station, it gets much more complex in terms of how you water plants, and that's sort of a separate talk. And my colleague Joy Amas is wrestling with those issues right now. She has an experiment going on the International Space Station. But you see examples of it. And the thing about the NASA work is it got in. There's nothing new about hydroponics. It's been around since Hoagland and Arnin in the late 30s. But I would say NASA kind of helped bring new species into this. Who would have thought of growing wheat hydroponically, or potatoes, or sweet potatoes? Rice actually is a pretty good fit for hydroponics. And as I say, we even use this for root zone crops. There you see, we were using nutrient film technique in particular at Kennedy Space Center, and we could grow potatoes doing this. It worked very well. And Mary, to just address the question you had, this got a lot of interest from seed potato growers. The seed potato industry, for every year they can stay out of the field, they save about 5% in the ultimate yield and quality of their seed, just from statistical buildup of virus and fungus. And if you have a 5 to 7 year production cycle of seed, that gives you much higher quality seed in controlled environments. This was something we didn't expect. We even tried peanuts. You have to get a little clever. You have to have openings to allow the gynophores to get down in the root zone. We didn't carry that much further, but it worked. We were kind of happy about that, and it just demonstrated the technique. So if you use recirculating hydroponics, you have a nice tool to track water use. We all know this. If you've done these kinds of studies, you can track nutrient use. And so this graph shows two potato experiments going from, on the x-axis, zero is planting to harvest, either 90 or 105 days. And then the water use is plotted on the y-axis. And you'll see that two studies, one was grown at higher light than the other one, and just track the water use. Of course, initially it's low because the plants are small and we didn't space them. We just started them at the final spacing, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But you see, we get up to in the range of something like 10 liters per square meter per day. That's a lot of water moving through the system. In closed plant growth systems, the number one gas moving through the system is water vapor. It's not CO2, it's not oxygen, and these are things we're very interested in terms of space life support. And when you talk with engineers, you have to set them that straight very early on, that there's an enormous amount of water vapor moving through these systems. And this is an area where I'll make a few comments at the end where I think vertical and agriculture systems could think about ways of retrieving some of this. A lot of water moving through. You can track nutrients. This is a graph plotting biomass as a function of photosynthetically active radiation or daily light integral on the x-axis. So one of those graphs in the upper left is biomass. We can track nutrient use. These are all convenient things to do. And you see in a lot of cases, acid is for our pH control. A lot of these things are a function of how much light you apply and how much biomass you're generating. Water use is a little more complex. It's not linear. It's affected by things like vapor pressure deficit, CO2 concentration, and so forth. But it gives you a tool to measure these kinds of data. Well, one thing that stood out from a lot of these studies that were coming in from university investigators and NASA field centers is that in controlled environments with these field crops, you could push them very hard. You could increase the lighting, and with CO2 enrichment and hydroponics, you could eliminate water stress, nutrient stress. So all of a sudden, you could get these remarkable yields in plants. And I think this is just an interesting footnote. I don't know how much it feeds into the vertical agriculture discussion we're having today. But it's something that I think was a very interesting finding. Bruce Bugbee and Frank Salisbury showed this with wheat. When I was working with Ted Tibbetts at Wisconsin, we tested potatoes and got enormous yields. Lettuce yields, you see to the left there, Neil, are you in the audience? A picture of Neil's with the lettuce plants there. We got 180 grams of fresh weight per head with a loose leaf variety of lettuce in 28 days. And many of you remember Maynard Bates, our colleague who was working for Pepperidge Farms, and Maynard said this is possible, Ray. I have a model that says you're just exceeding this, and I'd say, Maynard, what can I say? I mean, we grew them, we chopped them down, we put them on a scale and weighed them. And so these systems, if you operate them carefully, can have very high yields. Well, how high are you? And what can you expect in controlled environment systems? And I know Bruce is going to expand on this a little bit more, but I'll just make a few comments here. If you go into the literature, and I used one citation there, Loomis and Williams. It's an old one, but a very good one, and Radmer and Koch. It depends. You can get various numbers of how you define efficiency. It can be light absorbed, light applied, and so forth. But here's a number that you might think about, something like 1.6 grams of dry mass per mole PAR. Okay, that's a pretty good conversion rate and something to think about. And so if you go into the literature, that upper portion of the graph shows productivities of field crops. And in this case, they're just defining photosynthetic conversion efficiencies. And you see they're pretty high there. We've actually measured higher conversion rates than that in controlled environments. And then the bottom part of that graph shows some of the NASA-sponsored studies in controlled environments. And if I go back, you see that 1.6 there. And you'll look at those numbers on the bottom right side, and you'll see there's some numbers kind of getting pretty close to that in these controlled environment systems. The wheat tests at Utah State. Bruce, I pulled this off a graph that from a paper that you and Oscar published, and then I took some numbers that Ted Tibbetts and I published. And so point being, if you're a good grower and you can manage these systems, you can be very efficient. Again, these are field crops. These aren't the kinds of things that you're not going to compete with potato growers in Washington State. That's not going to happen. But for NASA, we're interested in this because we don't have potato growers in Washington State shipping us potatoes on Mars. And so we need to think about this. Another thing that it's a little bit peculiar for NASA's interests is that you're dealing with very tightly closed systems. You have to be closed by definition. You have to maintain pressure. If you're leaking your atmosphere, you got bigger problems than your crops not growing. And that's when you get in the progress module and get back to Earth. But this creates some interesting challenges in terms of managing these systems. And you see there's sort of an evolution there I'm showing of looking at closed system studies. You see a picture there of Steve Schwarzkopf at Ames Research Center. And then upper right, you see a system that Kerry Mitchell built at Purdue called the Minitrons and Johnson Space Center, and then lower right, Kennedy Space Center, and I'll show you more about that. Another thing, because these systems are closed, it just goes to, I want to just show you an example of how they do work. Plants actually, surprise, through photosynthesis generate oxygen and consume CO2. I mean, this is sort of proving the obvious. This is a set of data from a soybean test with a 12-hour light, 12-hour dark photo period, and you see the oxygen is stair-stepping upward in that graph. And it turns out, in our studies, we either had to ventilate the chamber or scrub the oxygen with molecular sieves because we had reached fire hazard conditions. We were doing these tests without humans. And it's kind of interesting, you know, plants were generating a fire hazard in a closed system. That's good. They're doing their thing. By the way, for folks interested in sensors, you'll see a little bit of a blip there in the oxygen right at the transition of light and dark. That's because we had a thermal period. We were changing from 26 degrees during the day to 20 degrees at night. And because of PV equals NRT, you get pressure changes when you do this in closed systems, and that affects things like oxygen sensors, CO2 sensors. The pressure then decays and leaks, and you come back down, but you have to be careful about your data during these pressure transitions. Okay, well, in a closed system then, if you're seeing this oxygen buildup and CO2 consumption, this allows you to track, say, photosynthesis through the life cycle of a crop. Now, again, this isn't really that helpful maybe for the practical growers, but it was a very interesting good diagnostic tool for us in doing these studies. And this is an example of two soybean studies. Again, time on the x-axis, start to finish, seeding it at time zero. And then the positive numbers represent net photosynthesis, and the negative numbers represent the night period or dark period respiration. So number one, you see two studies, one at higher light, one at lower light. So the high light, you get more photosynthesis. Lesson one, you see the beginning of the curve there, there's not much happening. I mean, this is greenhouse management 101. You don't waste your production space waiting for your seedlings to expand. You either grow them in a nursery and you transplant at 15 or days or so. I mean, we weren't thinking about that at the time, and certainly if you get to a functioning system, you're going to have to do that. This is pure waste. I mean, we'd get an F in greenhouse growing for this. Number two is that if you track along that upper curve, and you'll see it about 30 days, and I have a sign there, our canopy lodged. We were growing soybeans. This was the first time we did this, and we were so proud of ourselves, and they were growing, and so we got our bosses to come in, and like the day before they came, all the soybeans flopped over. And so we said, my God, the soybeans fell. And so we went in there, and we were trying to stand them up and all these things. But point being, you see that little dip in the photosynthesis curve. We lost 10 to 15% of our net photosynthesis by being, you know, bad horticulturists. And then you just go to anybody who's grown long stem roses or anything like this, and all you have to do is put a grid over your plants and let them grow up through it, and they have support. And again, you know, we get maybe not an F, but a D in that case. But very good diagnostics here with these kinds of data of gas exchange. You can see when the chamber overheats there. We had a lot of respiration at night. And we imposed a lot of manipulations there during the growth. Another thing this allowed you to do is if you're supplying CO2, and we were doing this in our studies, and in a closed system, you can shut off the CO2, and then the plants will just draw it down to some compensation point. This is a bit of a stressful experiment to do. You don't want your plants choking around in high light without any CO2 for that long. But what you do then is you take the first derivative of that curve and you plot it as a function of CO2, and you see a very classic C3 photosynthesis response curve. Well, the take-home lesson from this is if you want to get the most out of CO2 enrichment, you want to be out, you know, past 1,000 or something like that. If you get to 800, you're almost there. But you want to be out in that range to get maximum return on your CO2. Now, a lot of this depends on your system closure. If you have some ventilation, you just can't do this. But in closed systems, maybe, like Ed is talking about, you can CO2 enrich if you keep internal air circulation. We also had to worry, because of tight closure, we had to worry about things like ethylene. I don't think this is a big issue, for things like tightly closed CEA. I think you'll probably leak enough, but it's something to keep on the radar. That first stack of graphs just shows ethylene production. It's just concentrations in a chamber over time throughout a growth cycle. And then in the second stack, you see we plot biomass. And then I divided the ethylene by the biomass on that third stack. And this is kind of interesting to us. We got the most ethylene production when the plants were young and growing and expanding very rapidly. And we kind of referred to this as happy ethylene. I was expecting to see the most when they were senescing and dying and expiring, and that wasn't the case at all. We got the most when they were really cranking hard. With an exception, when we grew tomatoes, if you'll notice the graphs here, these are going to about 100, is my cursor there? Yeah, there you see, about 100 parts per billion. In the case of tomatoes, there's the 100 parts per billion. Here's the vegetative ethylene. And then when we get into fruit ripening, all of a sudden the ethylene just goes off the chart. And now we had a leaky system and it would have gone even higher. We leaked about 10% of our volume per day. But this is all from the climacteric production of ethylene fruit during the ripening. And we'd go in and harvest. We had to open the door. The chamber would ventilate, but it would build up very quickly again. And so the tomatoes won the ethylene derby hands down in the crops that we tested, but it's something you need to think about. And it even affected our plants at these seemingly low levels. Here are wheat plants at probably when they were, it was about 100 parts per billion, and we thought, you know, that's pretty innocuous at the time. And then we did more studies, and Bruce Bugbee's lab did a lot more thorough studies, and we found out through NASA sponsored research that you have to pay attention to ethylene even at low levels because you're chronically exposing plants to these things. So our wheat leaves rolled up like a soda straw. This was really weird. Photosynthetically, it didn't affect them. They were still intercepting the light, but it was bizarre to see this. And then you see potato leaves there at the right, only at 40 parts per billion, but a chronic exposure of ethylene. And those aren't normal potato leaves. So something we had to worry about. Okay, now on to the vertical agriculture and our attempt at it. This shows the plant chamber that we did a lot of these studies in over the years. This was located at Kennedy Space Center at Hangar L, and it's actually on the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a pressure hypobaric chamber that was used in the Mercury program. And it was converted to grow plants. So you see external air ducting there. With the light ballast, we had 96 400 watt sodium lamps. So that means we had 96 400 watt heaters cooking away inside the chamber. And then to manage that, and I'll get back to this a little bit more, you have to have a lot of cooling and air handling. On the lower right, you see the nutrient solution tanks. We had four growing shelves. The headspaces of these tanks were even vented back to the chamber to maintain atmospheric closure. So we were using NFT that would cascade through the system back into these tanks, so that would aerate the water. And we did control the temperature. Each of those tanks had water jackets around them that we could control the temperature. Redundant pumps. If we lost a pump, we could switch over quickly. NFT, like aeroponics, that, as you know, is not a very forgiving system if you lose your water supply, and you have to respond very quickly. If you have standing solution cultures or some kind of solid media, you have a little more time to respond. And then, of course, a control room. So there's a picture of the soybean plants in there. This shows two of the shelves, and then there's two more down below this. We had three sodium lamps above in each section there, above two trays, three 400 watt lamps. The air would come out behind the plants. You see those kind of perforated baffles, and then would come across the plants and then be drawn back in through the lamp canopy, so it would remove the heat on the outgoing pass. Now, I'll bring up a point at the end here in terms of energy conservation, of how you might reverse that flow and use the heat of the lamps for your natural reheat capability in HVAC. But we were in a circular system. This is sort of a peculiar geometry, but it's not for space. Very often for pressure vessels, you're much better off in cylindrical type systems. Square corners don't work well when you have to hold pressure. So a lot of this was custom design. Here we grew wheat, and I want to go back to a point that Ed made earlier, and with his cloth, we did not use any solid substrate in this. We only used nylon wicks. that we would wash out at the end of the studies and reuse. And that was by intent. We didn't want to have to lug along solid media, generate other sources of solid waste. And so it became a bit of, it was tough to germinate some of these things with these wicks like wheat. And Bruce knows this well. He had to counsel us numerous times. We were struggling with this, but we'd cover them up and keep the humidity high and so forth. But it was an interesting approach, and one that Ralph Prince, our colleague now retired, was really pushing. Here I opened the floor of the chamber. You can look down and you can kind of see all four levels there. We used to have an elevator that would go up and down in there. We took it out. I'd use it to go with a vacuum cleaner up and down to vacuum out leaves and things like that, but never used it that much. But you can see a vertical stacking of plants. So you have a shelf, a hydroponic shelf, a light bank, a shelf of lamps, plants, lights, and so forth. There's a picture of Neil and Lisa Roof, our colleague, harvesting lettuce plants. Lettuce is certainly a classic plant for controlled environments. As I mentioned, we did this with potatoes. There's Gary Studi's hand holding a potato right there. This was pretty interesting. I mean, I had done work with potatoes at the University of Wisconsin, and Ralph Prince insisted we're going to have to use nutrient film technique. He just demanded that you have this for everything. I said, well, why? And I'm not convinced you do, but we did this, and it worked. It worked quite nicely. Potato tubers they like good aeration. They don't like to be totally immersed. You don't grow them in fields that are poorly drained. They tend to get callus on them, and so lo and behold, this was a nice system for potatoes. We did make some attempts at automation. We had a robotic system mounted in the upper chamber that could come down on a telescoping kind of support system and then could go out over the plants and then swing around. So we had 3 degrees of freedom. We had a sensor head on the end of this, but we never got to the point where we built end effectors, you know, tomato pickers or leaf head clippers or anything. That would have been the next step. That deals with Nate, your labor problems, but in a pretty brutal way. So as a summary of that, you know, here's the yields. We plotted as a rate. I call it productivity, grams per meter squared per day, of the different crops. You see there as a function of light. A bright sunny day in June 21st is something like 55 to 60 moles per square meter per day, so that just to kind of give you a calibration on that curve. And you see a pretty, you know, a pretty defined response depending on the crops there, that light is driving the whole system. Well, to do that, this is going to get into the energy game here, and why NASA is a little bit disconnected from reality. But bear in mind, we work at a launch center where the next rocket we're building will have a propulsion system that requires about 100 gigawatts of power. So about 100 power plants all going at once just to launch one rocket. So these are the kinds of engineers we're dealing with. And as Ralph Prince used to say in talking with them, you guys are big, strong, and wrong, but, you know, we got it done. So in a small chamber like that, we have 96 400-watt lamps. And just in case, you know, we'll use sledgehammer tactics and we'll put 240-horsepower blowers in there to move a lot of air, which is important, as Nate pointed out. And so we didn't really have air circulation issues, except when we had very dense canopies. And then it was very difficult to get the air down to the bottom of the canopy, and we actually did have some fungal problems, just kind of growing on the dead leaves and so forth. Two 15-ton chillers, a ton of chilling is about 3.5 kilowatts. And then we would reheat the air. And this is sort of classic HVAC. What you do is you move air through your system. It's hot and humid. You run that over cooling coils, and you set your coil temperature to a dew point that you want. So you cool down to that dew point. You condense water out of it. That water can be retrieved, and we did that in our system. So we weren't losing our transpired water. And then you reheat back up to the temperature point you want. And so we had 100 kilowatt type reheat. So you know, again, not designed for energy efficiency. We weren't using those full power ratings and all these things, but lighting. Just a quick chart here. When we started this, you had a wide selection of lamps. We chose high-pressure sodium lamps. They were sort of the gold standard and really are still in many greenhouse settings. And when I've used this table for years, and when I started out, LEDs were up around fluorescent lamps. 15 years ago, LEDs were not that good. I mean, they just weren't in the mix. If you had 10% efficiency of red LEDs and maybe blue LEDs that were 3 to 5%, Bob, you remember this, that was about as good as you're going to do. It's changed enormously now, as you just heard from the first two speakers. State-of-the-art red and blue LEDs are probably greater than 40, maybe 50% efficient. This is remarkable to me. It just seems to violate some law of thermodynamics. I don't know how it's done. Plus, if you treat them well, they last a long time. So that's another cost in terms of system management. You don't have to replace them. They are narrow band, so those are issues, and I've already heard probably 10 papers at the meeting so far talking about how do you tailor the spectrum, what are the issues you have to think about with that. But kind of interesting issues for crop physiology. Let me get into the LED stuff a little bit more, because believe it or not, through NASA funding, the first group that proposed the use of LEDs to grow plants in North America, and I don't know if they beat the Japanese with Mitsubishi, was the University of Wisconsin group, sponsored with NASA funding, and one of the co-signers of the North American patent to use LEDs to grow plants is Bob Morrow, sitting in the back of the room. And you see a bunch of papers there, and there are many more that were sponsored with NASA funding to look at LEDs. And that was in 1990, Bob, is that correct? Even earlier? Have you made any royalties off of that?
No.
No? Okay. Well, there you go. So much for patents, I guess. Anyway. But it was something that was going to happen anyway. I mean, this was inevitable. But NASA, to their credit, was kind of out ahead of this, and they were a very nice fit for spaceflight kinds of systems. Another way, fundamentally different though, and NASA's also done some research here, is can you collect solar light? The answer is yes. I mean, this is done in various ways, and this is a picture of Takashi Nakamura, and Neil Yorio worked with him, and I did as well. And we set these solar collectors, these are parabolic mirrors, up on the roof of our building at Kennedy Space Center. These mirrors would reflect light to a secondary mirror, a dichroic mirror that would allow the long wave energy to pass through. You'd reflect the visible back onto a fiber optic bundle right there. You see the little white spot. And if you stick your hand in front of that, you'd burn the crap out of your hand. I know from experience. And then that would be delivered to fiber optic bundles that you could then send down into your building below, and it worked. It worked very nicely. You'd have to put these mirrors on a tracking drive so you track the sun as it goes across the sky. Keeping everything aligned perfectly was a challenge. The mirrors eventually corroded. Seagulls would sit on them and do their thing and so forth. And so, but the concept is there. And so it's something to keep in mind, I think, especially for us in space. But we have to worry about our settings in space. If you're at low latitudes on the moon, you have 14 days of light, 14 days of dark. If you're at the poles of the moon up on a mountain ridge, you maybe have 24 days of light, 4 days of dark. If you're traveling to and from Mars, you have continuous light. That's a great opportunity to use sunlight. So another option there where you don't incur a lot of electrical power costs, but it does have mass and volume costs. More recently, we've been trying to grow plants on a much smaller scale. Joy Amasa helped out a lot with this. This was some demonstrations done. You see the lower left, there was this habitat module that they put in the Arizona desert near Flagstaff. This was a test site that NASA uses a lot. And they had crew members in this, and they were driving rovers around and docking to this, and they said, well, can we put some plants in there? And the first year we did it, we had a whole shelf to ourselves, and we just set the veggie prototype unit, which is the system on the International Space Station right now, and had set it on a shelf. And then second year, more people got interested in this, and they said, you plant guys got to get out of here. I said, well, you know, is there somewhere else we can go in unused volume? And so one of the architects from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Scott Howe, came up with this. He saw what we did at Kennedy Space Center with these circular shelves, and he said, okay, I'll build a shelf like that around the elevator lift between the two modules. And so that's where we put the plants. And you see this first year we were using red and blue LED light, and so we had kind of the discotheque effect, you know, which some of the crew members liked. Others thought it was a little too odd. And then we went to white LEDs, you see down here, and that actually, many of them liked it because it provided extra light for the module. We proved the concept. We grew leafy vegetables in a human habitat. We're now moving this, hopefully, to the International Space Station. You see this unit called Veggie that Orbitech, Bob Morrow's company, built for NASA. It started with a small business innovative grant, a research grant. And then NASA decided we're going to build the real thing for the space station, and so there it is now. And Joya Massa, sitting up here in the third row, is the one really in charge of doing the proof of concept tests, and now Joya has a grant to do a more thorough investigation of growing plants with the Veggie system. There is the most expensive head of lettuce ever grown. I think we beat Jimmy. I think we beat Milan. I don't want to tell you what it costs. Okay. Well, what are some lessons learned from this NASA work in terms of CEA and then even to vertical agriculture? And Neil, please chime in. Gary, if you're here, chime in too. I'd say early on, over half of our maintenance headaches were really related to the nutrient management system. But bear in mind, we were a research system. We weren't thinking practical production type things. And so we wanted, calibrating pH sensors and conductivity things and adding acid and stock solutions and coming up with the right recipes for a given crop, you know, that took time and a lot of effort. We did recycle our condensate, and this is something that I think you might think about in terms of vertical agriculture systems. If you can get your hot, humid air up high and have your heat exchangers up high, condense your water up there, have some reservoir, you know, do your HVAC air circulation. Now you've got clean water up there that with a gravity head on it, can you use that to your advantage? Can you retrieve a lot of this water that's being transpired? We did a lot of work on optimizing hydroponic solutions. That's not a trivial issue when you're growing a range of crops, especially very diverse range of crops. And Cheryl Makoviak did a lot of work in that area. We use nitrate as our sole source of nitrogen. It's just easy. Nitrate's very forgiving. And so when in doubt, give them more nitrate. So we weren't too concerned about nitrate in the leafy greens at that point. They were probably too high. And we collaborated a lot with Wade Berry at UCLA to do elemental analysis. And I remember Wade, he was doing a batch of samples in a muffle furnace, and one of them went poof. I think we generated a biomass bomb that we gave Wade. There was so much nitrate in it. Those are things that you can manage. We chose to do it. And there's a reason for this, though. We were also into waste processing of the inedible biomass, and we found out that you could leach this out very quickly with big stirred tank bioreactors. So we could recycle those excess nutrients. They weren't lost to us. And so our decision was, well, we won't flirt with any level of nutrient deficiency. We'll just give it what they need. You have to consider reaching, one thing we had problems with in that particular geometry was reaching the ends of the trays. Now, the two designs that I've seen today, that's not an issue, and clearly people have thought about that in the engineering and layout, but if you don't think about it, it creates a lot of headaches. You want to be able to inspect your plants, get to them, troubleshoot things like that. Initially, we sanitized our system between crops. We would run dilute bleach through them, and then we tried dilute acid. And then you had to flush this stuff out. And there were always pockets that, you know, you'd run a, and so we did this once, and I thought we had flushed it out, and we wanted to be even more secure. And so after a bleach treatment, we ran dilute hydrochloric acid through. And I went in the chamber, and we thought we had flushed it out. I don't know what kind of gas I was breathing, but I'm sure it was bad stuff. And so we eventually gave up on that, because we were working with microbiologists, and they said, look, just sanitize. Instead of sanitizing, just clean it, physically clean it. Don't worry about it. And that seemed to work quite well for us. You don't want it to be dirty and stuff floating around when you put the new batch of plants in. So we gave up on sanitizing. Maybe every situation is going to be a little different, but you do want to clean and use common sense. I'll just offer this as a thought. Think about innovative ways of improving the energy efficiency. And one of these I mentioned was, can you use the heat of your lamps to an advantage? Now, Nate mentioned, even with LEDs, we think, well, LEDs are so efficient, we're not going to get any heat. Well, you know, if you got a 50 kilowatts of LEDs in a big facility, you got 50 kilowatts of heat. Sure, a lot of it's light, but it's all, if you go to a thermal engineer, he's going to say that's all heat, and it is. And so is there some way that you can use that to an advantage? And one way I'll suggest is, in classic HVAC, as I say, you chill down to a dew point and then you reheat. What if you take your cool air and blow that over the lamps first and use the lamps as your reheat, and then have that warmed up drier air that's conditioned now go over the plants and sort of kind of invert the heat and the cooling heat exchangers. Just a thought. And also think about recycling your condensate. If this helps you in terms of your water costs, if you're just blowing that transpired water out, if you can retrieve that, that should be a cost savings, I would think. But be careful about your heat exchangers. If you have copper heat exchangers and you're only using hydroponics, you're going to get a little bit of copper in the water, and if there's no buffering capacity, that can lead to issues. And we found that out the hard way. We had copper toxicity. We would run our condensate through polishing columns, and when they failed on us one time, we burned the roots off of potatoes because we had too much copper in it. Think about worker safety. We heard about this with scissor jacks from Nate. One thing that I've noticed in working with very high output LEDs, if you're even in just kind of glancing light, because these LEDs are off to the periphery of human vision, the photopic curve, we're kind of peaking in the green in terms of our sensitivity. And if you have bright blue LEDs out here at 440 or 450 nanometers, we're not seeing that like plants are. And so think about that for your workers. Maybe they ought to have sunglasses, especially if they're working on and repairing the lighting fixtures. Maybe as we explore sustainable living for space, we'll learn a lot more about sustainable living on Earth, and I think you could invert that. We certainly, in the space community, learn a lot from the terrestrial growers, and we'd be foolish not to. Of course, none of this can be done that I've shown here without a dedicated team, and this is a picture of our group kind of at the peak. It was a significant effort, you can see there. It's not that way anymore. Not all these folks were working 100% on it, but it was a great team. And then there was the extended university committee, folks like Carrie, Bruce, Bob Morrow, others I'm forgetting. Please forgive me in the audience here. So I think with that, I'll say thank you, and it's been great to be here.
Thank you, Ray. Do we have questions for Ray?
Yes, sir.
Did you explore the balance between or ratio of ammonia and nitrate in your nitrogen source to help the pH management?
Yes. The question was, did we explore using ammonium and nitrate as nitrogen sources and how that would affect pH management? Yes, we did a little bit, Bruce, with his student Don Muhlstein, did work on this. And as you might imagine, it does alleviate your demands for something like acid by adding a little bit of ammonium, because it's all a ratio of cation to anion uptake. And so when you use a lot of nitrate, you become anion imbalance and the pH tends to go up. So yes, we did, and that does work. And so that would probably be a better way of managing things. Each crop might be a little bit different. You have to be careful when you get toward the higher ends of ammonia. I think ammonia is a little less forgiving than nitrate. Yes?
In those capsules, did you automate pH control, or do you have all of that manually?
No, we had it automated. The question was, did we have automated pH control in the modules and the systems that we showed? In the large chamber, and in most of our growth chamber studies, it was automated. So we would use a pH controller. So you have a pH electrode that's giving you a continuous reading, and then you set a set point on that. Once it gets beyond that set point, it engages. We used a peristaltic pump that would add dilute acid, in our case, to the nutrient solution. And you have to be, there's a little bit of art to doing this. You don't want to have a big tank and be dripping your acid over here and having your pH sensor over here, because you're going to drip acid and drip and drip and drip. And then finally, when your pH sensor picks it up, you don't want a big wave of acid hitting it. So you're better off, I think, dripping close to the pH probe where you have finer sawtooth control. But yes, it was automated. Yes.
In your closed system, how do you manage your volatiles like ethylene or other methyl diazonate or something like that?
The question was, how did we manage the volatiles in a closed system? And the basic answer is we didn't, other than leakage, with some exceptions that I'll mention. But and so we were interested in what build up, and lots of things build up. All sorts of things come off of plants. And some of you heard Harry Klee's talk the other day about volatiles. A lot of the same things he was showing, my gosh, those are we picked those up in our chamber. We weren't completely sealed, and that helped us in terms of the volatiles, because you wouldn't get, they would leak out a little bit. We did some controlled studies with ethylene in particular, where we used potassium permanganate. We had little sort of screen baskets that we were hanging in front of the air intakes, and we used that. And it was obviously oxidizing other compounds. And so that did indeed bring down some of these organic volatiles. It's a big issue in space. Trace contaminant control is a huge issue. And it will be with plants, because they are adding their own things to the air. Turns out, though, probably the microflora associated with the plant root systems can also act to your advantage, because they could be consumers of some of these volatiles if they're soluble type systems. So, by the way, probably our two biggest biogenic gases, biogenic, not necessarily organic, were nitrous oxide, N2O. And we suspect much of that was coming from denitrification, probably in our root system. Even though we thought we were well aerated, we were still generating a lot of this. This is, any microbiologist knows this. And we also got a lot of volatile siloxanes. These are silicon polymers, long chain silicon polymers. And we know darn well where that came from, because I helped Ralph Prince with RTV caulking, sealing cracks around the upper edge of the. And so it's a silicon based. And it turns out that's a big issue right now in the International Space Station.
And there's some issues with human health?
In the case of space, they have set limits that they call spacecraft maximum allowable concentrations. Is that right, Gary? SMAC limits. And so for human health. And so, you know, to be honest, how they come up with some of these numbers, I don't know. They don't put humans in a box and expose them until they start feeling bad. I think it's done largely with animal surrogate studies, but so we know about that. It is a serious issue, and plants also probably have the equivalent of those kinds of things. How much do they tolerate? And Gary got into some studies of this for a number of years of trying to look at plant thresholds to some of these volatiles. I hope I answered your question on that. Yeah.
You mentioned putting hot air or cool air through the heating system, like the lighting system, to like pre-cool them almost.
Yeah.
And that way, sort of have the heating system, and then blowing warmer, drier over the plants after you.
Right.
And that's it. Do you have any idea about the dynamics of having essentially drier air in the canopy? How that would increase penetration versus the, I guess, the disease effect of having more humid environment? A greater load on the.
It wouldn't necessarily be drier. You would still run your cooling coil to the dew point you want in your operating environment. So you chill the air down to that dew point, and then instead of having a reheat like a hot gas bypass valve on a growth chamber, just use the lamp heat as your reheat source. So your air's coming off the coils at about 100% humidity and 15 degrees C, 12 degrees C, something like that. Blow that air over your lamps, and in the case of LEDs, this will help you. LEDs do better when they're cooler. And then they will warm the air up to 23, and now you'll be at 70% humidity or something like that. So you'll still control to the environmental set points that you want. Now, I'm not a good thermal engineer. I'm not a thermal engineer at all. I don't know what I'm talking about. But this is something that might not be easy to do, but I'm just suggesting it as an idea for energy conservation.
Thank you, Ray.
Okay, thank you.